Teacher and entrepreneur Will Fitzhugh left teaching and began publishing the Concord Review in 1987. Kathleen Kennedy Manzo interviewed Will in Education Week over 9 years ago and wrote, "Concerned that schools were becoming anti-intellectual and holding students to low standards, he thought the venture could fuel a national and perhaps even international interest in student research and writing in the humanities. As a teacher, it's not uncommon to have your consciousness end at the classroom wall. But I came to realize that there was a national concern about students' ignorance of history and inability to write. I wanted to recognize and encourage kids who are already working hard and to challenge the kids who are not." In an essay, "Art Without Craft," Will compared Michelangelo's early years to British artist Damien Hirst's work. He quotes Dave Barry, "Hirst, artist that he is, arranged this trash into an installation, which is an artistic term meaning trash that the gallery can now price at £5,000 sterling and try to sell to a wealthy moron. The next morning, in came the janitor, who, tragically, was not an art professional. When he saw the trash, he assumed it was trash and threw it away. I didn't think for a second that it was a work of art," he later told the press. "When members of the gallery staff arrived, they went out and retrieved the artistic trash from the regular trash, reassembled the original installation, guided by photographs taken the night before." Will summarizes, "So now, instead of hard-earned craft and artistic masterwork, we have junk that shows us that art is everything to do with love. I'm appalled by all this as one who loves the art of Vermeer, Michelangelo, and others. But I'm also concerned because some of the same debased and mindless standards are working their way into the expectations for and evaluation of academic writing in our schools. As you know, starting and sticking with something new is a challenge, often like scaling the tallest peaks over and over again. So I'll close by quoting Frost, 2 roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Welcome to Madison, Will."
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I really appreciate this opportunity. I've never had one like it before. I've spoken on panels and I've spoken to people at conferences and that sort of thing, but I've never met with a group of community people who share my concerns. So one of my worries is that I don't want to tell you a lot of things you already know. And I'm going to say a few things and give you a little background on what I've been doing. And then the plan is to have more of a town hall meeting and try to have some understanding of what you are concerned about here and see if I can respond in some way. I don't know how many of you have seen this advertisement, "Read Less, Know More." But Mark Bauerlein at Emory University, who just wrote a book called The Dumbest Generation, said that he was in a shopping center and he noticed an advertisement for the MacBook that said, "MacBook, the only book you'll ever need." So books are in trouble along with newspapers and everything else, but I thought I'd begin by a letter that I kept for many years. It was written to Beth Winship, who used to be the, whatever it's called, the advice person at the Boston Globe. And the letter says, "Dear Beth, I'm a straight-A student in mostly advanced courses. I work at the school paper and as an office and library aide. I'm respected by adults and some students, but 95% of the students make fun of me, tease me, and some have threatened me, all for being a smart, determined student. For the most part, I enjoy what I do, but when I keep getting the threats and quote-unquote jokes, I feel as if success is actually a cruel punishment. I have tried ignoring them or talking it out, but it's there." And Beth says, "Hang in there. You will relish college life after high school, where your talents will be recognized and valued." Now, as you undoubtedly know, life after high school turns out to be very difficult for a huge number of high school graduates. Just to give you one number, and I'll give you some more, but in Boston, Massachusetts, we have the MCAS, the Massachusetts Comprehensive Assessment System, and there's been a big battle over it. The Teachers Association spent $600,000 on ads to defeat it, and they weren't successful. And, you know, there's a huge campaign against standards and teaching and testing and competition and grades and everything else. But anyway, the MCAS is still there at about the 10th grade level. Some people say it's the 8th grade level in math. But the idea is if you pass the MCAS, then you've earned your high school diploma. And in spite of a lot of complaints and whatever, a number of students were passing the MCAS. And the Boston Globe, a couple years ago, reported that of those who passed the MCAS and are congratulated and are handed their high school diploma from a master's of public high school, if they go to community college in Massachusetts, 63% are in remedial courses. If they go to a four-year state college, 34% are in remedial courses. And I have something which I'd like to recommend to you, which I'll read a tiny bit from. But this year, there was a big campaign by Bill Gates, the Gates Foundation, and the Eli, I'm told it's Broad Foundation, not Broad Foundation. Anyway, they did that. And they wanted to inject or to introduce education into the presidential campaign, and they budgeted a lot of money. They only spent about a third of it and then decided it wasn't working, so they stopped. But they produced a report, I believe it was last summer, called Diploma to Nowhere. And this is the executive summary, and I can give you the website later on if you want. But it's a good introduction to the problem of school readiness, of college readiness. And I don't know if you've read some of the stuff I've written on Jim Zellmer's site, but the Gates Foundation hired a consulting firm called Bridgeband Group to do a study of college readiness and what it takes to get people into college. And a lot of the report talked about money, and how to get more money, and we need more money for people to get into college. But its recommendation for high school work was everybody should take a college preparatory curriculum. And one of my objections to that is that the college preparatory curriculum in the majority of public high schools does not include one nonfiction book or one research paper. So, I mean, if you're going to go to college and people are going to be assigned nonfiction books on their reading list, they're going to be assigned papers, they're going to be unready. You know, I don't see how that's so complicated to understand. But anyway, just a couple of items from this Diploma to Nowhere. When high school students enroll in college, as many as 1 million students fail placement exams every year. And this bothers me because it says that a lot of these students are students who did everything right in high school, the advanced classes, the good grades, and they still require extensive remediation. So, you know, we have demanding college curriculum and they take the courses and we give them the diploma and they arrive at college and the college says, what are you doing here? You don't belong here. You're not ready. So I think, as the executive summary here says, a hoax is being played on America, that we're letting kids out of school. And another part of the problem is that the people who write the high school graduation tests, and there are a number of states that have them now, a big fight in California over them and so on, and the people who write the college entrance tests don't talk to each other. So that there's no coordination between what the high school says you need and what the college says you need. So it just sets up, as it says, a million students for disappointment, surprise, embarrassment, and extra time to take remedial courses, most of which they don't get credit for. To some of the nation's most selective universities, like the University of Wisconsin and Madison, now test all incoming students in order to determine who needs extra academic help. Ivy League universities like Dartmouth offer year-long courses in remedial writing. An estimate is that this remediation is now costing about $2 billion a year, $2 billion a year. And that figure reminds me of another figure, which you may also be familiar with. The Business Roundtable did a study 2 years ago, I believe it was, of their member companies. And what they asked them was, are you spending any money on remedial writing for your new salary employees, new hourly employees, current salary employees, current hourly employees. And the results for the companies was that they were spending more than $3 billion a year. And it was interesting to me that it's about equally distributed among hourly and salary and new and current employees. So these are people who've been to college or they've been to high school or they've been whatever it is, they're supposed to learn how to write. And they can't do it well enough to meet the demands of the life in the business. So the extent of college remediation is far greater than previously believed. I gave you some of the figures from Massachusetts. More than 80% of students in Oklahoma's community college system are enrolled in a remedial course. Nearly 4 out of 5 remedial students had a high school grade point average of 3.0 or higher. That's a B, right? You get a B grade. You go to college and say, hi, I'm a B student. They say, no, you don't belong here. So, I think it's a disgrace, and as I say, it's a good report on it. So, you know, obviously there's a lot of stuff in education to talk about. I don't know most of it, and you already know this, but my focus is, I think, both narrow and absolutely fundamental, which is reading and writing. And when I started the Concordview, I'll tell you a little bit of the history of that, but I assumed that people would be interested in seeing exemplary work by their peers and by students and other teachers. And it hasn't happened, hasn't turned out to be so. But anyway, so I originally was interested in focusing on history and reading and writing. And as the years went by, the 21 years, and I met resistance after resistance after resistance, I became more interested in the culture and general attitudes toward achievement and so on. So that's how I got into that more recently. Now, this talk is labeled Varsity Academics, and I thought I should say a little bit about that. My understanding is that the word varsity comes from the word university, and that those people in Bologna and Paris and Cambridge and Oxford in the 13th century who started universities were not really interested in sports as much as they were in God, for one thing. And they were interested in academics. But somehow, and again, I don't know the historical background, somehow, at the high school level, and college level too, but at the high school level, the athletic department got it. So that there's varsity athletics. And I think it's interesting that I started talking about varsity academics about in 1995. I've been thinking about it a few years before that. And in 2003, I got a registered trademark for the Concord Review of Varsity Academics. And all you need to do is imagine somebody trying to get a registered trademark for varsity athletics. I mean, you'd laugh in your face. So for me, it's kind of an example of the difference, you know, the difference in attitude. And I've had people send a check to support what I'm doing and make it out to the Consortium for Varsity Athletics. But it's the natural thing to do. It's been useful to me just to keep to think about what's going on, our attitudes toward athletics and our attitudes toward academics, again, at the high school level. And I've still been surprised when I see things like a couple times I've been surfing the television, I come across nationally televised high school football games. And the last one I spent some time looking at every break in the game, one of the football players came to the sidelines and announced which college he had signed with. What's the academic equivalent of, you know, people? I mean, but there it is. You know, it's the contrast. The Boston Globe has about 150 pages a year, including 3 16-page supplements on high school athletics. And that includes pictures, interviews with coaches, you know, a little bit of information about what the athlete has achieved and all this kind of stuff. And essentially, I take the Globe and I look at it every day. Essentially, 0 pages on academics. It just isn't there. I was thinking, you know, one can be for women's suffrage without believing that men should lose the vote. You know, I'm not against athletics. I think athletics are great. But why is there some balance? It's just tremendously out of balance. later on I'll talk about this consortium, which I've started to try to survive. And one of the famous prep schools in New England, one of the trustees of the school offered to pay the $5,000 membership fee for the school if they would join the consortium, and sent stuff to the head of the school, and she said she didn't want to join because she thought it denigrated athletics. Say what? But anyway. So it's a very strange, one of my favorite stories, again, this is something that surprised me, I don't know why all these things surprised me, but in 1965, roughly, when Lou Alcindor was a 7-foot, 1-inch or 2-inch or whatever high school senior at Power Memorial Academy in New York. 60 head coaches at college basketball programs. I always say took his mother to dinner. That turns out not to be true, but they did give him attention, and they all wanted him and stuff like that. It makes perfect sense. But what surprised me about the story is that I found out that he got a personal letter from Jackie Robinson of baseball and from Ralph Bunch of the United Nations urging him to go to UCLA, which he did. Now, when I tell that story, I always say, you know, it's interesting that the 10 best high school history students in the country that year heard from no one, and it's been that way every year since. And there are no, and this is, you know, coaches come to the admissions office and they say, here's a list of the people we need, you know, we'd like to have admitted. History professors don't do that. No offense to any current history professors and so on. But there's a joke in that I'm somewhat involved in the National Association of College Admissions Counselors, and there's a joke, old joke, that says, all of our scholarships are need-based, you know, depends on the family income and all that kind of stuff. So if we need a quarterback, he gets a scholarship. And in fact, a lady I was on a couple panels with, Carol Lunkenheimer, used to be the dean of admissions at Northwestern. She's retired now, but I talked to her once. I said, do you have any merit scholarships for Northwestern? No, she said, no, all our scholarships are need-based. I said, well, what about the athletic scholarships? Well, that's handled by another department. So, I mean, again, I'm not trying to do away with athletics. They just, Jim Zummer gave me an excerpt from the local paper I have somewhere, which says that there are 10 to 12,000 students in the Madison area who are involved in soccer clubs or something, not teams. These are things outside of school, where the parents pay extra money and stuff like that. Now, that's fine, that's great, but 12,000 kids playing soccer. How many of those kids are submitting essays to the Concord Review? Well, the answer is zero. You know, I don't get any essays from Wisconsin or from Madison or whatever. So then the other thing that I think is interesting is you know, again, it's one of these sort of, can you believe this is happening simultaneously, whatever. There's a great concern. A number of people that I like, Diane Radich and Chester Fentz and all those people, are for years and years and years been talking about national standards, and a lot of efforts to, you know, national standards. And of course it can't be done for various reasons. But if you think about it, we've always had national standards in athletics. Imagine a team coming to play a football game at the local high school from another high school and say to the, you know, the two coaches meet, and one of them says, you know, at our school, we give 5 points for a field goal. And, you know, our team is not quite as well prepared as your, you know, our athletes are not quite as gifted as yours. So we would like you to give us 6 downs for 10 yards. You know, I mean, that doesn't happen. You know, it's absolutely well-established national standards. And in fact, I remember Michael Jordan once said that the place he felt most safe was on the basketball court. When he stepped over that line, he knew exactly what the rules were, what the standards were, everything. You step out of that, and you're in the world again. No, it's not certain. So and one of the things that gets me about that comparison between sports and academics, when it comes to standards and other things, is that it's interesting. I just got a long email from a coach at St. Andrew's School in Delaware. He's a guy who used to be on the Olympic team, rowing on the Olympic team. And he wrote me and said, I've written an article called History Scholar, which basically says if you're a history scholar, you're not going to hear from any colleges about this. And his librarian had given that. And he'd been wanting to write something for a long time about the fact that his rowers and he had relationships with college coaches over the years. You know, they, you know, call them, what do you got? Who you got this year? What's their score on the rowing machine? And, you know, there's a communication there. And he's never heard from anybody about his best history students. He's a history teacher. And the thing that gets me about that is that the coach frequently is a teacher, I guess almost always is a teacher. So as a coach, he's treated as an important person by colleges. As a teacher, he's nobody. And essentially, this, for the athlete, it's the same thing. I mean, I published essays by one boy just recently who was the wrestling champion for the state of Arkansas. And, you know, but as for his academic work, he doesn't get it. So we're sending a message, folks. We're saying, you know, if you're an athlete, you're important, you're valuable, we need you, we'd like to talk to you, we want to get your, you know, we want you here, get your help, and we'll pay attention to you, we'll get your help. If you're a scholar, we're not very interested in you. You know, what you do. And the same thing with a teacher. A teacher's not very important if all they do is teach. So, let's see. So the thing about college readiness, and there's a lot of data about that. And in fact, in Boston, just recently, I don't know why it hasn't been done before, but a group of people got together and decided to look at the class of 2,000 from Boston Public High Schools and see what happened to them. And two-thirds of them did not complete college by 2008. And of the one-third that completed college, that includes bachelor's degrees, associate's degrees, and one-year certificates. And it doesn't disaggregate it, so I don't know how many of each, but if you graduated and you got a certificate, you're a college graduate. And two-thirds of the graduates, again, these are graduates who passed the MCAS and got their diploma and all that kind of stuff. They didn't finish college and they didn't finish another degree within 8 years. And there's a lot of fuss about it. Northeastern University setting up a kind of 13th year or pre-freshman year or something to try to get people who get accepted to Northeastern ready so they can go into freshman year at Northeastern. But you know, a lot of places haven't done that. And yet the Gates Foundation, this idea is somehow go to college. You know, go to college and then forget about you. You know, that's not very valuable if you don't finish. And, you know, so I think it's nice that they're paying attention to that. Also, in this economic climate, I thought it might be interesting to announce that the public schools of the District of Columbia have gone into Chapter 11. Well, that's not true, but what Michelle Rhee and Adrian Fenty, the mayor, are thinking of doing is getting federal legislation that will allow them to declare an emergency, in which case they can bypass the union rules. I'd never heard of anything like that before. But it's interesting, you know, at the same time, General Motors and those guys are trying to figure out what to do. We do have schools who should declare Chapter 11. You know, two-thirds of our graduates can't graduate from college. We need to go into Chapter 11. Let's see. We did a study. I'd like to do two studies. I've done one. I haven't got the money for the other one. But in 2002, I got a grant from the Shanker Institute. Al Shanker was a good friend of mine, and actually, I got to know him just a few years before he died. But he nominated me for a MacArthur grant, and you're not supposed to know that. The reason I know it is because after he died, his assistant sent me all his letters, and one of the letters was to the MacArthur Foundation. And it actually was a supporting letter, and I said to Diane Ravitch that I got in the letter, and I said, it looks like, you know, not the nominating letter, but the supporting letter. And she said, yeah, that's what it looks like. So I think she did it. I know she's nominated me for other things, which I didn't get. But anyway, he's been a good friend. So anyway, the Shanker Institute gave me a small grant, and I hired the people at the University of Connecticut to do a study of the assignment of history research papers in American public high schools. It was not a Coleman study, it was a small study, but anyway, I did it. And kids are not being assigned 12-page papers or 20-page papers. And one of the main excuses is teachers say they don't have time. And we were talking about this the other night. If you have 150 students, you assign a 20-page paper, then that's, you get 3,000 pages, you have to correct, you know, over the weekend or whatever. But there are other excuses, and this may be blasphemous or whatever. I am a former teacher, so I suppose I can blaspheme a little bit, but there are teachers who do not like the idea of the mayor. Now, for some reason, this doesn't bother coaches. And Jim Zummer was a middle linebacker. He were a football coach in high school, and one of his players was a better middle linebacker than he ever was. He wouldn't be unhappy about it. He would think, good, you know. But I do think there are teachers who who like to underestimate their students because it makes them feel better. And, you know, the fact that one of them may be Colin Powell, another one may be, you know, a Nobel Prize winning physicist or whatever, they don't want to think about it. So they keep the standards low, and a lot of the papers I get are independent studies. You know, I have a wonderful paper I published in the fall issue on a 15,000-word paper on the Soviet-Afghan War, written by a kid at Lander International School who spent 18 months on it, and it was an independent study. There's no way it could have done it for a class. It wouldn't have been accepted for a class. So there are a number of kids who've just said, well, I care. They see the Carter Review, and they say, I'd like to try that, and I'm going to do it whether you like it or not. So I'm very grateful, by the way, to all the students over the years who have donated their work to me, because without it, I would have had zero. My story, briefly, I was a division training manager at Polaroid, which used to be a company in Boston. Anyway, in 1974, after the Yom Kippur War and the oil crisis, I got laid off with 1,300 other people, and I got into education, and I did some substitute teaching, and this and that. I finally got teaching history at the high school in Concord, Massachusetts. And in 1986-87, I got a sabbatical, and one of the nice things about a sabbatical is I do think when you're teaching here, at least I did, my horizon was like this, you know, this kid, that kid, tomorrow, this lesson on. But on sabbatical, at the time, it was 4 years after the Nation at Risk report, which I hadn't read. But Diane Ravitch and Chester Finn had written a book called What Do Our 17-Year-Olds Know?, which was a result of a study of 8,000 high school juniors and tested in literature and history. And that came out. Cultural literacy came out. And Theodore Sizes, Horace's Compromise came out. So I read those and I began to realize that what I was concerned about, other people were concerned about, there was wider issues and so on. And it's interesting, the sabbatical year was the same year that our high school had its 10-year accreditation thing. So I missed it, but when I came back in the spring, the results of the accreditation were pasted on the principal's window out looking out into the corridor so you could read it. And I looked at it, and every single one of the things was an input variable. You know, the floors are clean, the library has books, the teachers have degrees. Although nothing about whether the kids learn anything, whether they're going to flunk out of college in the first year. So at the time, as you know, I mean, back in those days, 1987, there was a groundswell, or there was a swell, whatever it is, of interest in outcomes. You know, we're spending all this money on education, what's coming out? What are the kids learning or so on? So my idea was, well, I've had students who've done more than I asked them to do. And there are 10 teachers in the social studies department. They all have kids like that, two or three, whatever, four. There are 20,000 high schools in the United States and others overseas. So maybe if I ask those kids to send me essays, I can put together a quarterly, 44 essays a year with good stuff. And the purpose being, A, to find and celebrate and recognize and publish exemplary work in history by high school students, and B, to distribute it as widely as possible to challenge their peers. Well, A worked out and B did not. I mean, it's been very, very difficult. And I'll tell you one story. I published a number of essays from Green's Farms Academy in Connecticut. And the history teacher there was wonderful. He'd send me a couple of good, wonderful ones every year because we're going to Harvard, yeah. So I went down to visit one time, and I had published an essay by a boy and a girl from the same school, so I hoped to meet them and also meet him, which I hadn't done before. And I went into his office. He was the head of the history department, assistant headmaster. And I went into his office, and there were three or four unopened boxes of Concord Reviews in the office on the floor. So anyway, and so he said, okay, you know, we'll come and visit a class, but don't say very much because you have to talk about the Concord and get ready for the AP exam. So I said, fine, you know, I came to the class. And I said, to save time, why don't I see if there are any questions about the Concord Review? And the girl in front row raised her hand and said, what is the Concord Review? So this is a school where probably six kids have been published over the, you know, that period, 4 or 5 years. and two of their peers recently been published. I had lunch with, the boy was sick, so I didn't see him, but the girl, I had lunch with her and her teacher. Her name was Sarah Balkenberg, absolutely wonderful kid. There's an interview with her on my website, by the way. But anyway, I had lunch with her, and I said, you know, she was all-state soccer, as it turned out, in Connecticut, which may not be like Ohio or something, but anyway. And I said, did the kids in the school know that you're all-state soccer? Well, yeah, they do, you know. I said, do they know you've been published in the Concord Review? Well, no, they don't. Now, she wrote an essay on the Great Awakening, and this is in her interview if you get to see, you go to see it, but she went to Dartmouth and played on the Dartmouth soccer team. I graduated summa and went to and spent a year doing research at Mass General Hospital in Boston. And then she applied to 13 medical schools. And the last interview she had was at Harvard Medical School. And one of the older professors on her interview panel, and they all looked at her background and he said, what tell us about the Great Awakening? And she said, you know, I hadn't thought about it since I was a sophomore in high school. No, I did the best I could. Well, she's now finished at Harvard Medical School. I've lost track of her. She's a wonderful, wonderful girl. Anyway, it gives you some idea, again, of the difference between recognition available and you know. Anyway, let's see. So again, I started the thing, and there's a few things. I really got the idea in March of 87. We were incorporated in June of 87. I sent a brochure, a little four-page brochure, to every high school in the United States and Canada and 1,500 schools overseas. And by the end, I had to teach after my sabbatical year, while I was teaching, I got subscribers in 14 states and 4 countries, so I thought, great, that's a good start. I got essays. So I was able to publish the first issue in the fall of 88. And I spent my last $100,000 to get it started, including my teacher pension. And the first 14 years I worked without a salary, and it has been a lot better since then. Last year my salary was $8,600. But briefly, this is sort of the chronology. 87, I said that. I had to suspend publication in 91 and again in 95 for lack of funds. I wrote the subscribers and I said, I'm suspending, but you know, if I try to come back and then I'll pay you and give you the 4 issues when I come back. And only a couple people canceled their subscription, so that was very nice. In 1995, I started the Ralph Waldo Emerson Prizes, which are 44 essays a year, and I usually choose 4 or 5 as Emerson Prize winners as being outstanding. And as people always say when they give prizes, it's very hard to choose, and it really is. There are a lot of good papers, I think. Again, I have to tell people, this is not university history. Okay? This is not cutting-edge history. It's not going to change the field of history. But it's outstanding high school homework. That's what I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to distribute outstanding high school homework. In 1998, I started the National Writing Board, which is an independent assessment service for research papers by high school students. They send a paper. I train a few readers, I send it to 2 readers, they read, they don't know anything about the kid, they write a 3-page report, send it to me, I put the 2 3-page reports together in a report, send it to the kid, and we've been endorsed by 39 colleges and universities, including Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, Virginia, Michigan, some other places. But it's a really bare bones operation. We only really have 3 good readers. And we don't get that many papers, but we send reports to 79 colleges now. And the colleges have endorsed and did so because they knew about the Concord Review. Well, if you do the Concord Review, you probably have the same standards for the writing as you do. I told the kids not to steal from George Washington, but when we were doing the reader training, they said, let us raise a standard to which the wise and honest can repair, is what Washington said, the Constitutional Convention. And they've done a good job of it. And I can send you copies. Some of the reports are really wonderful, but they're so respectful, they're not condescending, they're serious, they make concrete suggestions for sources, and they treat the kid like a scholar, which is what the kid is. Let's see, 2002, we did the term paper study. Also in 2002, I founded the National History Club, and at the time I had a sponsor who's now stopped helping me, but so he decided, it's a very bad scene, he decided to take it away from me, so he did. And then he may stop, he's funding that separately, but he may stop that in December, so I don't know what's going to happen to him. But the moment, there are 340 chapters in 42 states and three other countries with about 8,600 members. We don't tell them what to do. You know, they have a history club, they do what they want with their history club. In that same year, I started the Concord Reduce Society, which was our alumni organization, intended to keep track of people and also try to enlist some support with people who become CEOs or whatever. That's also now gone. I had two employees, they're both gone. 2003, got trademark on Barkey Academics. 2007, you know, my funding went from 320,000 to zero in 2006. So I started something called the Consortium for Barkey Academics. The goal being to get independent schools, public high schools don't have any money, to get independent schools and some other people to support, you know, what I'm doing. And hopefully, you know, maybe help me hire somebody to take my place when I drop dead, there'll be somebody there. The consortium now has 24 member schools and national partners, and I could give you the schools include Groton, Andover, Deerfield, Singapore American School, Polytechnic School, Pasadena, which is across the street from Caltech. And the partners include the History Channel, Boston University School of Education, American Council of Trustees and Alumni, Reed College, and some other people. So, excuse me. So the funding has been a problem. I've been turned down, all sorts of weird turndowns. Theodore Sizer was on my board for a while. He wrote an introduction. He used to be the dean of, he was the head of Andover for a number of years. And he was the dean of the School of Education at Harvard for a while. And he was a good friend. He wrote an introduction to the first issue, which was very nice. And he talked to somebody he knew at the Pew Charitable Trust about funding, you know. And somebody called me from there and said, oh, we think what you're doing is great. We'd like to give you $50,000. I said, oh, wonderful. He said, well, we'll call you back. Called me back in 3 weeks and said, oh, we had a meeting. And somebody said, you know, if we do this for history, we'll have to do it for English. And that was the end of that. So, I mean, I've really gotten some bizarre turndowns. Al Shanker used to talk about it. I sent a copy to the Mellon Foundation, which is, it turns out, and I don't know if it did then, but it doesn't anymore doing 312, but the program officer for the foundation read the entire issue and then turned it down. So, anyway, let's see, I'm almost done. I ran across something which I hope is a good analogy, because I'm always thinking about how to explain why, I should say there are exceptions. I was talking about this the other night here. The first issue had an essay by a girl from Santa Catalina School, which is a girls' Catholic school in Monterey, California. Really? Well, Brett, you ever know Brett Oder?
Yes, I recognize him.
Well, what happened? Well, this is 1988.
It's after me.
Okay. Well, I published an essay by one of the kids, and he sent me a message, said, we'd like 57 subscriptions. And, of course, I fainted that away. Well, they now have 80. And Singapore American School has 125. But there are 20,000 high schools in the United States, and we probably have maybe 600 subscriptions from them. And so we, after 21 years, we're not really there yet. But the other day I was thinking about an old story I heard about a worker at one of the South African diamond mines who would leave work once a week, and he was pushing a wheelbarrow full of sand, and the guard would stop him. You know, they're very concerned about diamonds, right? Guard would stop him, and he searched the wheelbarrow and didn't find anything, and sent him on. This happened week after week, month after month. And finally, the guard said, look, I know you're stealing something, and, you know, I'm not going to do anything to you. I just want to know what it is. And the guy said, wheelbarrows. I think of this story when teachers find excuses for not letting their students see the exemplary history essays written by their high school peers. Cambridge Regional Lab School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the district teacher there said, I don't want my students to see them, they might plagiarize. So there are always a lot of excuses. Sometimes they say they can't give their students copies unless they can teach the contents. So it doesn't fit, they can't see it. Or they already teach the topic of one of the essays, or they don't know anything about one of the topics, or they don't have time to teach one of the topics, or they don't think students have time to read one or more of the essays, or they know something the author didn't know, or they worry about plagiarism or something else. There are many reasons employed to keep this unique journal away from secondary students. They are, to my mind, searching the sand. The most important reason to show their high school students the journal is to let them see the wheelbarrow itself, to show them that there exists in the world a professional journal that takes the history research papers of high school students seriously enough to have published them on a quarterly basis for the last 21 years. Whether the students read all the essays or one of them or none of them, they will see that for some of their peers, academic work is treated with respect. And that is a message worth letting through the guard post. Whatever anyone may think about or want to do something with, the diamond's inside. And one last story, and I'd like to hear what's on your mind. I read a lot of science fiction in college, and one of the books I read was called High Vacuum. And the premise of the story was that in your training, this was, you know, long before the Apollo program, which I worked on as a matter of fact, but anyway, this was how to train cadets for outer space and this, you know, work in spacecraft. And they figured out that one of the things you have to do to get cadets really prepared for living in that environment is to teach them that vacuum is an enemy that's trying to get in and kill them. In other words, you don't try to keep the air out from getting out. You keep vacuum from getting in. I mean, it's just a way of thinking about it, okay? And I like the idea, I like using that idea as a metaphor for mediocrity. Because I think a lot of people think of mediocrity as the absence of something. You know, it's just, well, it's not as. Whereas my view is that mediocrity, there is such a thing as high mediocrity. And we would not have achieved the very impressive levels of mediocrity that we have in our school system if we didn't have tens of thousands of people who go to work every single day to make sure it happens. Well, that's the end of my prepared remarks.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Will.
So we'll open it up for questions and discussions. Anybody want to jump in first?
Yeah. Yes.
Janet?
I'm Janet Burks.
Oh, yeah.
Let me just give you a story related. Last month, I was interacting with the Daily Press related to an article.
Well, I've seen
that I published about students with exceptional math ability.
Yeah.
Corresponding to.
Well, I've seen it all kinds of places.
And I had back and forth correspondence with the education reporter from the New York Times because she was going to do stories in the New York Times. And, you know, well, one of the things I kept saying to her is, you know, I don't think the New York Times has ever published an article about the U.S., you know, winners of the International Math Olympics. Mm. You know, it's just part of, you know, what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, every little high school sporting event.
Yep.
And I was saying, you know, the article that she eventually wrote, she had pictures of the girl members that had been on the U.S. Olympic team and, you know, who won medals there. But, you know, one of the things I was trying to do is say, you know, it would be really fantastic if we could have this as a page one story. And she said, well, it's almost impossible to get anything on page one. And, you know, I'm having this debate back and forth. Well, see if you can get your editor putting on page one. And a few days before, while we're having this discussion, page one has a football, high school football story, you know, with a picture of, you know, some high school football. And, it, you know, it's not like the top football team in the country.
Yeah.
You know, they're just talking, yeah. And almost every week, the New York Times on page one has a story about some high school sporting event.
No,
one
of mine.
And yet, until I got my article published, you know, last month, there had never been a single report, even a little tiny inside story.
Now see, that's fine. We didn't have a problem with reading, writing, math, and science. Now, in other words, if everything was fine, well, fine. We have a huge problem, you know? I mean, this remediation is out of control. Oops, I shouldn't be shy. It's not supposed to be right. So that, I mean, yeah, it is. It's disgraceful. Pet peeves is that you get Parade magazine here on Sunday. Well, Parade magazine has the high school girls soccer team, you know, the Parade high school boys soccer, you know, whatever, everything. Every, you know, must have 10 a year of the best high school athletes in a particular sport, boys and girls. And I can't get them to say anything about the College Review. And I was thinking, I should say I'm very grateful to you for coming, and so I'm not saying bad things about that, but here's these 10 to 12,000 kids in this area who are soccer kids, right? And they're putting a lot of energy into that. Suppose I were the parade person, come to do a story on the soccer player, you know, pick people from the Madison area to be on the soccer team. How many people do you think would be here? No, I mean, it's just not as popular to talk about good academic work as it is. Now, there are reasons for that. I mean, there's money to be made in soccer, probably more than in history and so on. But, I say, you know, if everybody were doing fine, I think it would be less important. But we have such a great deficiency of, of course, I'm very biased, you know, because my idea is to teach by example, is what I keep saying, you know, to show kids. I mean, we have, you know, kids go to games all the time, and they see their peers doing stuff. They don't see their peers doing much academically. So that's what I mean by teach by example. Show them, show kids, look, this is what your peers are doing. What do you think? Anyway.
Yeah. Next question. Jeff?
I was just sort of thinking about the story you told about the girl who was the all-state soccer player. And I was thinking about the way in which athletics are celebrated, but there's a way in which you're supposed to be embarrassed about being intelligent. Yeah. Where, and this gets at sort of an issue that we talk about in my psychology classes about intelligence, whether or not intelligence is something you're just born with and given, versus whether or not it's something that can be grown and developed. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a tendency to see it as something that you're just bestowed upon. And so therefore, if you have it, well, you know, you shouldn't feel special.
I completely agree. I studied enough psychology to have heard of attribution theory. And for a long time I've been saying that I think what we decided to do is that everybody should know that to be a great athlete, you have to have both ability and effort. And to be a great student, you have to have both great ability and great effort. You know? But for some reason, we've decided that athletes, like Dustin Pedroia just made MVP, the second baseman for the Boston Red Sox, and he's an embodiment of effort. I mean, he gives himself over completely. Everything he does, he got a Gold Glove as a fielder and more most valuable player as a batter or as a second baseman. But we've decided that athletes can be celebrated because they're making an effort, and we don't think about the ability so much. And just as you say, when it comes to intellectual achievement, the effort is not part of it. You're just smart, you know. So why you can't be proud of your genes? You can't say, oh, look, I have better genes than you do, you know. So but I think it's really dumb to separate, to try to exclude the other part of the equation. And that's another thing I like about these kids that I publish is they really, people always say to me, oh, isn't it nice? Laura Bush wrote me a nice letter and said, oh, I love to read stuff by talented students. And I didn't get a chance to respond, but I like to say, look, it's diligent. You know, it's talented and diligent students. It's not just bright kids. Kids are working it. The kids have spent 18 months on a paper. I'll tell you one more story. Mako Sasaki is a girl at St. Mara International School in Yokohama. And she spoke English from the time she was a little kid. But anyway, she was an IB student, and she knew she had to write an extended essay. So she had seen a photograph when she was about 15. She'd seen a photograph of the kamikaze pilots. And she said to herself, these were people my age. Why did they commit suicide? And so she started looking into it her sophomore year. She spent 2.5 years. She went to every museum in Japan for the kamikazes, and she interviewed survivors. She interviewed people who had taken off to die in a plane crash, or the engine died, so they were saved. So she really did the background. And one of the things I published the essay, obviously, but anyway, one of the things I liked about it was that her question basically was what drove them to do it? Why did they do it? And her conclusion after 2.5 years was, I don't know. I mean, if that isn't scholarly courage, I mean, I can't figure it out. It doesn't make any sense to me. You know? Anyway, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, now you're just continuing on this topic Jeff brought up about in the United States, there is this attitude that, you know, you either have the ability to do it or you don't academically.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, and if you don't, then it's perfectly okay not to learn. Yeah. Whereas in sports, you know, even though we all admit there are some people who are more gifted than others in sports, it's fine for everybody to participate, everybody to do it. But that's a U.S. problem.
Yeah.
Other cultures don't have that. You know, so you know, one of the things in my study was the difference even, you know, between Asian Americans and you know, U.S. born white kids,
yeah.
where there was this huge disparity because the Asian American kids were growing up, you know, with a culture of, oh, if you're not doing that well in math, you just need to try harder,
yeah,
and you can do
yeah,
better.
Right.
You know, just like in sports.
Yeah.
And, yet somehow we have this thing that
Yeah.
Oh, if you're not doing well in math, you must have the math gene. It's perfectly okay not to do well in math.
It's really, you know, it's such a disservice because one of the television programs, I think it was CBS, had a series about what's going on in schools. I remember one guy was interviewing a couple of Asian girls, no, Asian American girls, maybe 13 and 12 or something, or 11. And at one point, you know, we're talking about achievement and working and doing stuff in school. And at one point, the guy asked the 13-year-old, didn't she have a hard time studying or didn't feel pressure from her peers not to study? And the look on her face was like, my peers? What the hell has that got to do with it? You know, my father told me to study, I'm going to study, you know, he'll be with these terms following, you know. It was wonderful. But, you know, one of the things that, and it was sort of, I don't know if it's the elephant in the room or not, but there's an enormous amount of money spent on teen culture. You know, live fast, die young, and make a good living corpse or whatever, but, you know, be a teenager. Don't be a student. Don't be, you know, be popular or be like play the music or whatever it is. Don't do what your parents think you should do. Be Miley Cyrus or whatever it is, you know. And there's a huge amount of money invested. I mean, it's not just a part of the culture, it's a real investment in, I also feel that educators are somewhat to blame for not supporting kids in reading and writing. I sometimes feel like, you know, all these people who talk about hands-on learning and want kids to do community service or community action, you know, I feel like it almost could be summed up by saying, put down that book and no one gets hurt. You know, step away from that book and no one gets hurt. You know, we're going to go on a field trip or we're going to go change the lawn in Wisconsin to, you know, something. Don't study. Don't sit there and read. Anyway. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any question that money is driving lots of different things. But what I was struck by at the beginning, you were talking about the amount of time and money that's being spent on remedial education in our university system,
yeah.
Which is just a huge industry.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
You know, and it would seem to me that if there were more pressure at the college and university level on the lower levels of the educational system to do better, then they would probably do so.
Yeah, well, first of all,
and
we
also,
don't talk
it did
to
seem
each
to
other.
Me that most of the remedial stuff you were referring to was actually about remedial writing.
Well, I mean,
not as much about remedial math.
There's more math than there is writing. One of the things it says in a Diploma to Nowhere is that there are more math, more students in remedial math than remedial writing.
Are there actually?
But the kids who are in remedial reading who don't make it can't do anything else. That you have to have reading in order to do anything academically. So it's very important. Of course, it's my bias, you know, reading and writing. So, but you know, I'm told, I don't have the numbers on this, but I'm told that colleges make money from remedial courses. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, they would say, well, it's a lot of money. It's like people complain about the money in presidential campaigns, but most of that money goes to the media. You know, they're not unhappy about it. You know, they like the campaign to go on for 4 years, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sort of saying this without knowing the numbers, but I...
Are there any studies that actually looked at whether or not that's actually a profit center for universities?
I think so, but I'm not aware of them. No. But I do think people are aware of it.
I don't think state universities
make money.
They're not happy about it. Yeah, I
well, it certainly extends the time of graduation.
That's what I
Wisconsin.
Don't get a credit for it, so
no,
you have to buy more credit.
Yeah.
You have to take it.
No, but you pay to take it, you get no credit. Except in places like Wisconsin, where we have a state university system, where the state taxpayer is subsidizing the cost, you know. It costs more than $7,000 a year to educate a student.
Yeah.
And so the state indirectly is subsidizing the cost of that education. So if these students take, you know, 5, 6, 7 years to graduate instead of 4, people aren't happy about that.
Well,
there's a lot of pressure to want people to graduate in 4 years.
Yeah.
And if they come in and they're
But is there really? Because what I'm really struck by, I mean, I actually attended a state system myself, different state. And what I was really struck by there is that it seemed to me that the university system was making very little effort in the 1970s to structure things, to create, to make it easy for people to graduate in 4 years. I would actually say that there seemed to me to be institutional barriers to graduating 4 years, and I had to figure that those were there for a reason, that they actually served some function for the university system. And now I'm living in a different state, I see the same thing. Got to be some reason why it's rational for the institution to set it up that way. Because I've also gone to school and taught in an Ivy League system where everybody graduates in 4 years.
But certainly, it's a good research question, and maybe we could use a little more data, but
that's what
thing
if there
are
studies.
Another thing that occurs to me is that the people who teach remedial courses may not be paid as well as other people on the faculty.
Yeah, they're usually lower level instructors. You don't need to use someone with a PhD to teach.
So they may make more money than
ninth grade math.
That's what I'm thinking. It could actually be a kind of profit center in a way that it's sort of hard to see.
Yeah.
I've read a little bit of what was on one of the sites that was linked in this invitation to come, and that was one of your ideas was a page per year.
Yeah, sure.
Do you know of any school district who's doing that or paying teachers? I mean, I'm one of the high school English teachers probably doing my best not to contribute to mediocrity, but we're exhausted.
Yeah, no, I know.
And there's nobody that, you know, we take our sick days to stay home and read papers.
I did too when I was teaching.
And, I mean, seriously, how many sick days do we take a year? At least.
I understand completely.
So, I mean, other than that's a case of money too. I mean, who's paying us to?
Usually I don't know what it is, grassroots movement or legislation or whatever. I talk to people about it's a page. I can't sell a page for your plan. It's just common sense. You know? So I've had a few people say, "Oh, this is a good idea. Can I use it?" They don't know what I'm going to do about use it. You know? But I'm very aware. I was involved in a Teaching American History Grant program in West Virginia, and I talked about this. And somebody who was there was from the State Board of Education. They came up, and one of the things I said is, if you want teachers to teach, to give kids research paper assignments, and maybe this was too modest, but I said you have to build in 5 days into their schedule, a day at the beginning, a day in the middle, and 3 days at the end, so they can give some feedback on the papers. And that may not be enough. I mean, look at the time you spend on coaching football. Yeah, that takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time. You know, you can't produce good football players unless you spend time on them and you have practice. Let's assume we're trying to produce good readers and writers. Kids are not doing it. Not doing it right. As long as you're the English department, I was an English major at college, so I think English is fine. But what I say is that as long as the English department controls reading and writing, the reading will be fiction and the writing will be personal, creative, and the five-paragraph essay. Now, I know there are exceptions. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to publish 835 essays. But for a lot of people, I remember there was a story about an English teacher at a high school in New York State who decided, I'm going to have my kids read a nonfiction book. And the way they have to pick something from the New York Times bestsellers. So 6 or 7 of the girls chose Paris Hilton's autobiography. It was on the New York Times. it's very hard to get, and there's no time, So, it's like we're not asking because we're not serious. And I think that's an important point too. I think kids are not stupid, Kids, if we don't treat reading and writing, for example, seriously, like you have to read a book a year and you have to write a paper a year, they know it's not important. if it were important, like blocking drills or tackling drills, you'd have to do it. So we also, not only are we not doing it, we're sending a message that it's not important to do it. I agree with you anyway. It's very time consuming.
Jeff?
You know, I think the issue of the demands we place on teachers is a really important one.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I get multiple choice tests because I can't grade 350 essays.
Yeah.
And if we really want to increase rigor, you talk to any writing instructor, and they'll say writing is critical for developing that thinking ability. But it takes time for teachers to grade it. You've got to cut down on class sizes.
But see, if it weren't serious as a sport, we would take time out of it. Harvard Business School has readers for papers, they hire and they have more money, but they have signed cases, and there are people who go and score the cases and give them back to the teacher that doesn't do it. I feel bad about it, because I feel like, first of all, it's obviously something kids need to be able to do. I don't know if you like it or not, but I really like Charles Murray's new book called Real Education. And he talks about the fact that it's not a realistic goal to expect 100% of American students to be proficient in 2014. He completely ignores academic ability. And not everybody is above average. I mean, it's just one of these things that we can't get a hold of. But, lost my point. Anyway, it's a good book.
Follow-up question. Well, it's related to the college thing. It's probably because I've got a high school senior, so I'm going through this whole process. But the standardized tests that the kids are having to take now have actually all introduced a writing component, and it seems like an awful lot of the colleges are asking for the writing component.
It's
minimal requirement, but doesn't that create a little bit more incentive?
Well, I'll tell you something. I think it's a travesty. The National Writing Project gets $21 million a year from the federal government to teach thousands of teachers to feel better writing about themselves. Diane Ravitch got me on the steering committee for the National Assessment of Educational Progress Writing Assessment in 2011. So I sat in the meetings and looked at some of the report. And one of their buzz phrases is writing on demand. That what's important in life is writing on demand. Well, I think it's nonsense. I mean, but anyway, so that's their excuse for having 2 25-minute essays. And this is true of all the writing tests. Ugh, I don't want to know about the writing tests, but one of the things about the writing tests, they require no knowledge. You cannot ask somebody about the Crimean War because you don't know if they know anything about it or anything else. So you've got zero knowledge to start with. So what can you ask about? You can ask them, what's their opinion on school uniforms? 25 minutes to write. And I'm not saying you can't tell anything. I mean, if a kid writes four words, that gives you an indication. They write both sides of the paper, gives you an indication, so on. But writing on demand, I mean, certainly in college, you're not asked to sit down and write a research paper due tomorrow. I mean, you have a chance to study and think and rewrite, but it's not, and the same thing, you say, well, it's like that in the workplace. It's not like that in the workplace. Your boss doesn't come. Well, I mean, I've had some different jobs, but if you have a boss that comes to you on Friday, says, I need a report by Monday, I mean, he doesn't say, I want a report in an hour. I mean, usually.
No, but sometimes you have to respond to something relatively quickly.
But
you
don't write
it right back fast.
Well, okay, but for the most part, two things. Usually you have a couple of days. It seems to me you've got to have a couple of days. And second of all, you know something about whatever it is. You have some background. So you're responding out of a history of knowledge. So, I mean, it's complete fraud. I think the writing test is a complete fraud, the SAT writing test. Plus the fact, I can send you stuff on this. There are services in Boston and elsewhere which for $1,500 will spend 12 or 14 or 15 hours with you preparing a couple of essays, which you then learn and take to the SAT writing test. And because the prompt is so general, you can say, oh, that reminds me of a time when I used to do your essay. Oh, absolutely. And it's very well known. And the College Board says, there's no way anybody could change. I mean, they've got their head in the sand, It's a fraud, it really is. So, I mean, that's why.
Lauren's got a question over there.
Yes?
I guess I would have my assumptions how you'd answer this, but I wonder what your observations have been in talking with teachers and administrators from public high school versus private.
I don't know, I sort of meant to indicate, I don't talk to anybody. Jim Selmer said to me, I was complaining as I always do, you know, I don't have any money, I can't do this, I can't do that. And he said, why don't you give speeches around the country? You know, what's his name? What's the guy always talking about? No competition, no standards.
Yeah, that's right.
Alfie Cohn. You know, Alfie Cohn gets 200 speeches a year, $5,000 a speech, so he gets $1 million a speech. Anyway, what I said to him was, well, you have to be invited. And I commend him for saying, for then inviting me. I mean, you know, so many people say, yeah, that's you, but to be invited. So anyway, now, but I don't even meet students. I mean, if I ever get somebody to take my place, I have to explain to them, well, first of all, the salary's not very good. Second of all, job security is not very good. Third of all, if you love kids, you'll never see them. I never see kids. You know, I do love kids. I love high school kids. I really, you know, care about the ones I know. And so, you know, I don't get invited to talk to teachers or administrators. Part of my problem is I haven't written a book. You know, if I'd written a book and somehow they, oh, you have to come in and meet. So I'm busy, but I'm by myself and I'm putting out 900 pages a year plus doing all that stuff. But anyway, difference between public and private. Sometimes people say to me, why don't you publish more essays by public school students? My answer to that is I cannot publish essays I do not receive. Now, you know, the AP history program does not include research paper. Nevertheless, there are some crazy teachers who teach AP who assign research paper anyway. You know? And I've had some wonderful ones of those. The International Baccalaureate doesn't assign. It assigns a 4,000 to 5,000 word extended essay for the diploma. So I've had many of my international papers are those. I've extended essays. But private school people have more time, and the parents expect it, and the administrators expect it. So it's part of, you know, they have time. Say, what do you say?
Maybe smaller class sizes.
Oh, absolutely smaller. But you know, it's built in. In other words, that's one of the reasons the class is smaller, because they know, because they understand what they're asking, and they allow for it to be done. You know, I was saying the other night, my first visit to Groton School. I walked down the hallway with my guide, and they were, you know, rows on each side. There were 5 or 6 chairs, 7 or 8 chairs. And I said, what are these? And they said, oh, they're classrooms. I said, well, what are you talking about? You know? So, yeah, it makes a big difference. But, you know, I've had, you know, for me, it depends on the teacher. I mean, I've had teachers. There's a guy at an older high school with a PhD in American history. He's now retired, I'm sorry to say. But he was the kind of guy that, you know, you sort of the famous teacher that everybody dreaded to be in their class because they knew they're going to have to work really hard. And then they worked really hard and they felt great. You know, that kind of stuff. I published a bunch of his essays. But when the teacher leaves, the essays stop. I published some essays from Bronx Science. Teacher left, no more essays. So I depend very much on teachers to get it done. Yeah.
I saw Alfie Cohn this summer about the homework myth, and I'm curious what your take is on homework.
This is Alfie Cohn wrote the homework myth?
Yeah,
I haven't read any of Alfie Cohn's books.
Basically says that there's no statistical evidence that shows that homework increases achievement, and that any studies that say that really tie in the homework grade into higher levels of achievement.
Well, I would look for a parallel study that says that practicing before football games has no effect on your success in the game.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's nonsense.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying a lot of homework is crap, you know, it's busy work. And there are even colleges, I remember that people were saying at one point Vassar didn't make the top whatever, and they started piling on homework. You have to be intelligent, you have to have common sense, you know, to assign homework, it has to be useful. And I've said this before too, but when I was teaching, I wasn't a great teacher anyway, but when I was teaching history, I used to assign a reading in the textbook, right? And the next day the kids would come in, and they hadn't read it, and so I went over it.
Right.
So why should they read it?
And that's why, I mean, I started adapting in my classroom what he was talking about in the homework myth.
Yeah.
And I've actually seen a difference. Like, my kids are just sitting down reading today. And I've given them that handout. 3 or 4 of them might have read it tonight. But tomorrow we can take a test on it or talk about it, knowing that everyone has read it.
If it works, do it.
Yeah.
You know,
But the problem, you know, the problem with a lot of it is that you never really talk about it. You know, you never really think about it. I mean, we had one teacher in my school, a wonderful teacher who got the University of Chicago, had a law degree from Columbia. He was sort of our prize teacher. And he taught really Socratic and sort of law school. You know, people come to class and you can call on them. Would you please discuss last night's work, you know? they did it, you know? Right. And then you have something to work with. And, well, do you agree with this? I can't do it, but he did it. You know, you've got people fighting and disagreeing and thinking all sorts of stuff, you know? So, you know, if you can do that, I just think, you know, I partly because I'm against Al Capone in general, but, you know, he's not only against homework, he's against testing and standards and competition. Mm-hmm. And I just wish he would go and talk to a group of coaches and say, you know, competition is bad and standards are bad, and, you know, and get thrown out.
Anyway. Lori.
Number one, you should write a book. Number two, we were hearing a lot about the problem, all the numbers and descriptions and whatever, and I'm hinting at what the answers might be, the why, the answer to the question why. But I really am interested to know your and anyone else's deepest thoughts about why our cultural values are biased in the way they are right now. Or if you would prefer, this is related by third question. I'm going to ask, have you ever met Al Capone?
No, I haven't. He's in Cambridge. I sent him stuff, like, you know, he talks about, a lot of these guys talk about what we really need, like Howard Gardner's another guy. He talks about we need to be more serious, think more deeply, and get more, you know, analytic. And I said, well, that's what I'm doing, you know, but they're not interested. I have sent information about the car. I'll get back to your tough question then.
I have one more.
can you remember it? Because I'm going to try to remember the other one.
Yeah.
But I've sent information about my efforts to every faculty member at the Harvard School of Education and never received a response. I mean, everybody there, you know, no offense to any psychologist who may be present, everyone there...
School of Education is so different from what part
well,
of
okay,
psychology.
But I mean, I'm telling you, everybody there is interested in developmentally disabled, impoverished, you know, there's nobody at the School of Education who has any interest in academics that I can find. Look on the website, look at all the research interests. Nobody's interested in chemistry, calculus, Chinese, history, literature. Now, why is our culture like that? Well, I'm obviously not, you know, good enough, but one of the things is that, you know, there's this sort of, I don't know if it's anti-European or, you know, we're what is it, exceptionalism. America is exceptional. And one of the things we do is we're hands-on. We're doers, you know, we admire. So sports, and it feeds into that much more than that. I mean, you know, the schoolmaster was not highly regarded and usually didn't stay very long in New England villages and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a loser. You know, so there's a lot of feeling that education is for losers. And that's why we pay them and that's why we treat them. I remember when I was in Congress, you know, my family came to Virginia in 1670 and I had two Harvard degrees and all this kind of stuff. And people in Congress said good things about the teachers, but they wouldn't want their daughter to marry one. You know, I mean, it's a very low status occupation. I mean, so is just sort of being a policeman, so is being a postman, and, you know, and so on. But I just think that cultural attitude has been there for a long time. That intellectual stuff, not, I mean, if you're a scientist, it's different, or if you're Bill Gates, and you're, you know, if you do something to make money, then that's okay. Doctors used to be, I don't know what it is now, used to have the highest status of any group, of any profession. My father was a doctor. And it's because they were scientists. And they cared about people, and they made money. I mean, they had the best of all possible worlds.
And yet there are some subcultural groups even in our country who value learning for the sake of learning. You know, and a couple of those groups are represented here tonight.
And look, where would I be without the Jewish kids who I published?
Well, and the Asian kids.
And the Asian kids. I learned, I studied a small history of China, and correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the things I heard was that in China, over the millennia, if your child did well in the examinations or whatever the jobs, you know, the jobs with the emperor, whatever they were, your entire family status was raised. And that's a big family. So was there any interest on the part of the family in having you do your homework?
Yes.
You know? But there was an investment. So I couldn't be more grateful for 7,000 years of Jewish history, or 7,000 years of Chinese history, or Asian history. Now there are some non-Asian, non-Jewish kids who work hard and send me good essays, you know. So, but it's a wonderful, you know, it's great to have that. And I probably said my wife is Jewish. If I weren't doing what I'm doing, if she were Jewish, we would be divorced or I'd be homeless or something. I mean, the fact that I'm a bum, I'm not making any money. But, you know, from her point of view and her mother's point of view and, you know, with the whole family, I'm doing something worthwhile, which is wonderful. Because I'm not a success, you know, but that doesn't matter because I'm doing something, you know, academic. So, you know, yeah, it's wonderful. But it's not the general culture. It's not the people who go to the NASCAR races, you know.
I don't keep being convinced of that. I just, you know, the puzzle as to why and why it's gotten so extreme, and, you know, it's a tragedy. It's a national tragedy. But
And nevertheless, our educational system, at least at the higher education levels, is considered the envy of the world.
Yeah.
Well, although that's a good segue to my question, I'm curious, Will, have you had any conversations with admissions officers, university admissions officers, about the preferential treatment given to athletes, all of whom know now where they're going next year, whereas the regular kids haven't even, you know, met their deadline yet. There was the regular admissions.
Oh, yeah, I was going to...
The preferential treatment in terms of the admissions process,
well, I don't, you know, I haven't challenged anybody. I did ask Carol Lunkin, I heard Northwestern, as I said, and she said, well, the merit scholarships are handled, you know, athletic scholarships are handled somewhere else. The problem is, you know, Harvard has the same problem. I mean, everybody has the same problem. You need a trombonist or whatever it is, or a bassoonist, and you need a basketball player. You know, you're going to have student activities. And by the way, Harvard alumni go to the games, and they fund, you know, they bring money, maybe not as much as Michigan or Ohio or whatever, but Harvard alumni... I mean, some of my peers, all they want to talk about is Harvard sports. I could care less about Harvard sports, but, you know, they're interested in that. So, there's, you know, there are incentives. What I'm saying is there are incentives for instance, you know, if you're one of my kids, you don't get a four-year scholarship to college. But if you're a dancer or a singer or, you know, something like that, there are $4 million in four-year scholarships available for outstanding artists, high school artists. And you know something, I blame the professoriate to some extent because I feel like the professors complain about the ignorance and the poor preparation and the academic incompetence of the students. But what are they, you know, I know professors are busy too, you know, they're writing books and they're, you know, doing research and they're doing stuff. But they're certainly not doing what the coaches are doing to make sure they get, you know, that the kids are well prepared. I mean, if, you know, if the coach at Ohio State got the top kids they could, and they were all bumbling at, you know, he would raise their eyes. He would go and tear up the high schools and say, why aren't you preparing? I cannot beat Michigan if you give me kids like this.
Yes,
you know?
But Will, don't you think that's because they are usually running PhD programs? I mean, my experience in graduate education is that the faculty members take a very active interest in who their graduate students are.
Oh, yeah, fine. But, you know, by that time you've had the winnowing process, and that importance, that value, doesn't transfer down to the high school student who's working hard.
Yes.
I mean, that's all, you know, again, I said in the beginning, I'm limited, my view, I'm from lower education. I'm a lower education person, you know.
Well, and I had taught undergraduates at Yale who didn't know where TAs came from.
Where what came from?
TAs.
Teaching assistants.
They didn't know where they came from. Who were they?
Oh.
Where did they fit into the system? They didn't understand that the teaching assistants, who they had in multiple classes, were actually graduate students on their way to become professors.
Yeah.
It just never even occurred to them, where did their professors come from? The whole system.
Oh, yeah, sure. No, it's not part of their experience. And I repeat myself, but I just, you know, if we didn't have a problem, it would be okay, but we have a tremendous problem. I mean, we, you know, our kids are not college ready. But what?
Any other questions, comments?
Well, I'll just add that I can appreciate being an oboist or
a
middle linebacker or a, you know, center forward of the basketball team. But why do they get to know that they're in a year before, and why do they get to be in the
Because they're needed. They're needed.
Well,
there's competition.
Are they needed that badly?
Well, you know, this is another point that people often make to me is the coaches' jobs depend on the performance of their athletes.
No history professor is fired because their students are, you know, ignoramuses in history. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I'm exaggerating, but, you know, coaches are, you know, so they, I mean, I've got an article from the Globe that there's a girl who's just, you know, signed with Boston College, and she's been, since she was a freshman, she's been receiving mail from coaches. So, I mean, the coaches are entrepreneurs. They're trying to build.
I think the argument they use, they get away with, but it's focused. So, for example, you know, my younger son goes to University of Chicago now, and you know, they're a Division III school, and if you talk to most of the undergrads there, they'll say sports is a joke here.
Yeah, sure.
That, you know, I you know, they had family visiting weekend, you know, and they had a home football game. Which they tried to arrange for people to be there. You know, there was this picnic, and the football game started. And so I got to see, you know, the University of Chicago football team. And it looked like a third of the kids shouldn't be playing football at all.
Well, I mean, that's not fair.
The team, you know, was a lot worse than, you know, Madison West High School team.
But, Chicago is so self-consciously intellectual, and you shouldn't even discuss it. What about the Caltech football game? I mean, you know.
But the thing is,
there are 3,400
you know, well, say that I went to MIT at a time when they proudly proclaimed how they had every sport but football. They did not have a football team, and it didn't stop getting alumni contributions. The scam of saying, we have to have top sports teams, is that's the way, the only way we're going to get our alumni.
I don't think that should be necessary. It shouldn't be necessary to do without sports in order to pay some attention to academics.
No, they weren't doing without it. The teams are there. The kids who want to do it.
Boston University,
they don't give athletic scholarships.
Boston University just dropped football because they were losing $10 million a year on it.
Yeah. So places like, you know, Caltech, MIT, Chicago don't give athletic scholarships. If you want to come here and play a sport, that's fine. We have the sports. You can go and play them in Division III.
When you talk about college admissions, I know a story. The dean of admissions at MIT is a lady named Mary Lee Jones. Let me tell you a story.
She paid your visa.
That was my story.
But you were a phenomenal admissions person.
But Thomas Sowell wrote a book called Inside Higher Education. And one of the stories in there was about MIT, that the math professors went to the admissions office and said, the kids are not as good at math as they were last year or the year before. And what Mary Lee Jones and company had decided that they wanted more interesting classes. So they were turning away 800s in math level 2 and admitting people who had a colorful background. It's a bit important to realize, and I'm sure there are exceptions, but college admissions people are not academics. They're psychologists, so they're social people. Okay, they're not real psychologists, but they're good with people. You know, like we were talking about. So their job, and they, a lot of them.
They're good talking to the parents. They're good talking to the parents.
Oh, it's a terrible job. I mean, you know, Bill Fitzsimmons and company has to go through 27,000 applications. You know, they do a hard job. But for a lot, and you know, let's not just talk about Harvard, Chicago, MIT, and Caltech. There are a lot of colleges and universities. And a lot of the admissions people are people who you know, try to get interesting classes and so on. They're not keyed into academics that much.
Well, the other thing is that most of these big schools have departments of institutional research where they're actually tracking, you know, what the characteristics of the matriculants are and then how they behave during their years in school and how well they do afterwards, presumably including how much they contribute to the university afterwards. I'm assuming that most of the admissions decisions at these schools are actually being driven to some extent by in-house institutional research.
Well, you know, it's interesting that Margaret Spellings, who's asked universities to account for whether they're teaching their students anything or not, getting a lot of grief from colleges. You know, they had all this information. I mean, you know, as I said, Boston, for the first time ever, has found out what happened to the class of 2000. So I don't know whether, you know, universities know.
I think they do. Whether they share it with us is completely different question.
Well, what the elite universities share is what type of employment is the first jobs they get after graduation.
Yeah, it's really limited compared to what they probably actually know.
Yeah, because they always love to say, you know,
of our graduating class, you know, 10% went to law school,
yeah.
You know, 7% went to mid school.
Getting back to, is it Judith Light?
Lori.
Her name is Lori. But getting back to her point about, what, you know, anti-intellectualism in American life or whatever it is. Suppose the Harvard, you know, Harvard admissions office, or you know, the institutional research arm or whatever, looking at the class, and they find out that Bill Gates was a graduate and is going to give them a lot of money. He didn't even graduate. You know, he dropped out. So, you know, it may be that the people that, that they tell the admissions office they was are not academically gifted. Or, you know, I mean, it isn't just academic giftedness. It's important.
Well, I'm assuming they have several different kinds of things they might be looking for in terms of outcome.
Yeah.
I'm just making the point that I suspect they track that actually fairly well, and that they're, that a lot of their admissions policies and other ways in which they run the institution reflect what their research tells them.
Well, is this, this must be tied into the Alumni Association, right?
I suspect it is.
So, I mean, a lot of it has to do with money.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, if you want an interesting, scary read, read Daniel Goldman's, I believe I've recommended this book to you before, The Price of Admission.
Yes, I've read it.
And it's, you know, about the intimate relationship between the admissions office and the donor.
Absolutely.
However,
goodbye. Well,
thank you.
Right, before you leave, are
thank
your
you.
Teachers? Thank you. Are you your teachers? Are you?
Yeah.
I want to just focus a little bit because I'm curious what this looks like to teachers.
I thought that this was kind of going to be, so I think we were, it came with a different expectation.
You got copies of the journal, did you?
It's,
no. Oh, here, I got it. I can get it. I'll get to it.
Well, this is a broad
idea. Also, look at the website. Send me an email.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Good night.
All right. I think we're done. Thank you for coming tonight.
Yeah.
Yes.
Timing is just perfect.
That's right. All right.
Who says we're not wrong?
Will Fitzhugh's Madison appearance was made possible by the generous support of Active Citizens for Education, Madison United for Academic Excellence, www.schoolinfosystem.org, and several donors who wish to remain anonymous.